from the...
Well, I'd like you to, if you've got your book, if you could open to page 354, please, because what I'm suggesting in the next number is that we simply read here, because the efficacy of the argument is not that logical part that I just went through in section six, but simply discovering the natural, what he calls here, natural spontaneities and inevitabilities that we're here affirming. And it's really hard to shut this off, you know, to shut off question. And in that sense, it's an inevitability. When you're faced with something new, you're going to want to try to understand it and so on and so forth. So I'm going to start at the top of 354 and just read a couple of pages, because the alternative was to write, type it out. And it's easier to just do it this way. So Aristotle said to the skeptic, if you get the skeptic to talk, then once they talk, they're going to make a proposition. And at that point, you can catch them in this logical argument. But anyway, that derives its efficacy not only from the conditional necessity of contingent fact, but also from, this is what he wants to get, this is new now, the nature, the natural spontaneities, the natural inevitabilities that go with that fact. Why is it that the talking skeptic does not talk gibberish? Why is it that one can count on the skeptics being nonplussed by self-contradiction? Point out the self-contradiction, they're going to be taken up short by it. It is because the skeptic is conscious, empirically, intelligently, and rationally. It is because he has no choice in the matter. It is because extreme ingenuity is needed for us not to betray our real nature. It is because were our ingenuity successful, the only result would be that he had revealed himself to be an idiot and lost all claim to be heard. This aspect of the matter deserves further attention. Cognitional process does not lie outside the realm of natural law. There's a lot of later work where it's really clear natural law for Lonergan consists in the attentive, the intelligent, the reasonable, the reasonable. That's what is natural law. Cognitional process does not lie outside the realm of natural law. Not merely do I possess the power to elicit certain types of acts when certain conditions are fulfilled, but also with statistical regularity, the conditions are fulfilled and the acts occur. I can't escape sensations, percepts, images. All three keep occurring during my waking hours, and the images often continue during my sleep. No doubt I can exercise a selective control over what I sense, perceive, imagine, but the choice I cannot make effective is to sense nothing, perceive nothing, imagine nothing. Unless I just make a choice to just sleep all the time. Not only are the contents of these acts imposed upon me, but also consciousness in some degree is inseparable from the act. Nor is that consciousness merely an aggregate of isolated atoms. It's a unity that I call I. Okay, so again, it's just going over the same material, but it's adding more force to it with each articulation. If I can't escape presentations and representations, empirical consciousness, neither can I be content with them. None of us wants to live simply with. There are times when you've got to go into the mode of just being in the flow, okay? But you can't stay there, and you don't want to stay. Spontaneously, I fall victim to the wonder that Aristotle named the beginning of all science and philosophy. I try to understand. I enter without questioning the dynamic state that has revealed in questions for intelligence. Theoretically, there's a disjunction. So I don't deliberately enter it. It's just spontaneous. I enter. What is this? What's going on? Theoretically, there's a disjunction between being intelligent and not being intelligent, but the theoretical disjunction is not a practical choice for me. In other words, I don't want to be stupid. I can deprecate intelligence. I can ridicule its aspirations. I can be envious of people who are smarter than I am. I can cut them down to size. I can reduce intelligence's use to a minimum, but it doesn't follow that I can eliminate it. question everything else, but to question questioning is self-destructive. I might call upon intelligence for the conception of a plan to escape intelligence, but the effort to escape would only reveal my present involvement. And strangely enough, I would want to do a good job with it. I'd want to go about it intelligently, and I would want to claim that escaping is the intelligent thing to do. Inevitability here that we're caught in. As I can't be content with the cinematographic flow of presentations and representations, so I can't be content with inquiry, understanding, and formulations. I may say I want the quarry, but not the quarry, but the chase. But I'm careful to restrict my chasing to fields where the quarry lies. And above all, I want to understand, still I want to understand the facts. Inevitably, the achievement of understanding, however stupendous, only gives rise to the further question, is it so? Inevitably, the progress of understanding is interrupted by the check of judgment. Intelligence may be a thoroughbred and exulting in the race, but there's a rider on its back. Without the rider, the best of horses is a poor bet. Sometimes he has good sentences like that. The insistence that modern science envisages an indefinite future of repeated revisions does not imply an indifference to fact. On the contrary, it's fact that forces the revisions. It tosses into the wastebasket the brilliant theories of previous understanding that will make each new theory better because it's closer to the facts. And what is fact? What is that clear, precise, definitive, irrevocable, dominant something that we name fact? Question is too large to be settled here. It will be settled as we go along. Each philosophy has its own view on what fact is and its consequent theory on the precise nature of our knowledge of fact. All that can be attempted now is to state what we happen to mean by knowing fact, and we'll go in the next paragraph into knowing fact is a matter of putting these three together. Now, I'm not going to read all of that, but I just wanted to emphasize the business on this. Inevitabilities, spontaneities and inevitabilities. And if I could refer your attention now to page 356 in the last paragraph there of that section, because it's a very important sentence there. Self-affirmation has been considered as a concrete judgment of fact. The contradiction of self-negation has been indicated that it would be contradictory, logically contradictory to deny the judgment. Behind that contradiction, there have been discerned natural inevitabilities and spontaneities that constitute the possibility of knowing. Not by demonstrating that one can know. Again, it's not a logical demonstration. But pragmatically, by engaging one in the process. And here's the sentence that I want to call to your attention. Nor, in the last resort, can one reach a deeper foundation than that pragmatic engagement. The notion of foundation. Nor, in the last resort, can one reach a deeper foundation than involvement, engagement, pragmatic engagement. Foundations is not a set of propositions from which conclusions can be drawn. Foundations is pragmatic engagement in activities. And you can't go any deeper than that. Even to seek a deeper foundation involves a vicious circle. For if one seeks such a foundation, one employs one's cognitional process, these activities. And the foundation to be reached will be no more secure or solid than the inquiry utilized to reach it, the pragmatic engagement in raising questions. As I might not be, I might be other than I am, so my knowing might not be, and it might be other than it is. The ultimate basis of our knowing is not necessity but contingent fact. And the fact is established not prior to our engagement in knowing, see, through propositions and conclusions, but simultaneously with it. So that, what I wanted to call your attention to there is that it's the first, no, it's not the first, I think it's the second time in the book, the whole book, where the word foundation comes up, particularly in our modern context of anti-foundationalism. I want to call to your attention what foundations means all along the water. It does not mean a set of propositions from which other propositions can be derived. It simply means a set of operations that we are inevitably engaged in if we're human. Nothing more than that. The pragmatic engagement in the operations is the deepest foundation. Same thing is true when he articulates foundations in terms of conversion in method and theology. It's not a set of propositions. It's a momentous change in person. And it's at that pragmatic level that foundations, if we may still use the terminology. So in other words, what I'm saying is that the modern critique of foundationalism does not apply to our notion of foundations. Any questions? Next, number 14. Is this self-affirmation descriptive of the thing for us? Is it describing me? Or is it explanatory of the thing itself? Is it explaining something about who I am? Human science contains an element that is not found in natural science. So a difference between psychology and physics, or psychology and biology. While both begin from inquiry and insight into sensible data, human science also enjoys through consciousness an immediate access to its object. Now, there's a lot of course, behavioral scientists who would say that's nonsense. The data of consciousness are not to be taken into account. And any attempt to use the data of consciousness as evidence for a scientific statement that's completely objectionable. Well, there's a lot of other human science that would disagree with that, and Lonergan's in that second camp. Human science enjoys through consciousness an immediate access to its object, namely the human person. Lonergan's initial use of this access was descriptive. This is what an insight is like. Sometimes it can be very exciting. Sometimes it's sudden, and so on and so forth. Those are all descriptions. But the initial procedure of description gradually yielded to definition by relation. Insight is related to sensations and questions and concepts and judgments and so on. And any definition by relation is explanatory, defining things in relation to one another. The defining relations obtained immediately between different kinds of cognitional state or act. But definition by this type of relation is explanatory. So descriptive procedure was superseded by explanatory. So this judgment is an affirmation of an explanatory understanding of the human person. That's what he's saying. This is science. This judgment is a scientific judgment. That's what he's claiming. It's a scientific judgment. It's not just philosophical. It is philosophical, but it holds status as a human scientific judgment. Explanatory about the relations of the elements to be discovered in the data of consciousness. Next, 50. Moreover, there's an important difference between explanation on the basis of sense, as in the other sciences, and explanation on the basis of consciousness. I mentioned this a little bit last time. 358. Explanation on the basis of sense can reduce the element of hypothesis to a minimum. In other words, the more experimentation you do, the closer you are to a virtually unconditioned, and so on and so forth. It continues to hold up at all different kinds of experimentation. Well, it's probably true. It can reduce the element of hypothesis to a minimum, but it can't eliminate it entirely. But explanation on the basis of consciousness can, in given instances and in given judgments, and not all the time, escape entirely the merely supposed, the merely postulated, the merely inferred. He's saying this judgment is a virtually unconditioned judgment. Scientific judgments in physics, chemistry, biology are not virtually unconditioned. They're problem, as we saw in the last class. But this is a virtually unconditioned judgment. I'm not merely supposing, I'm not just postulating this, I'm not just hypothesizing it. Where the first, the explanation on the data of sense, on the basis of the data of sense, where that cannot eliminate hypothesis entirely is in the set of primitive terms and relations that the system employs in formulating all its laws. the notion of mass that I used the last time, which is what he brings up here. Mass today is probably pretty much a primitive concept in physics. But we don't know. Something else may really relativize. The further discoveries may relativize the foundational or basic nature of the notion of mass. So its concepts as systematically significant, as ultimate or derived, as preferred to other concepts that might be empirically reached, do involve an element of mere supposition. For the selection of certain concepts as ultimate, let's say in physics, for instance, occurs in the work of systematization, and that work is provisional. At any time, a system is accepted because it provides the simplest account of all the known facts. But at the same time, it is acknowledged that there may be unknown yet relevant facts, that they might give rise to further questions that would lead to further insights, and that the further insights might involve a radical revision of the accepted system. So that whatever is covered by the notion of mass would still get covered, but maybe in an entirely different way. But explanation on the basis of consciousness excludes the radical revision that involves a shift in the fundamental terms and relations of the explanatory account of the human knowledge underlying existing common sense, mathematics, and empirical science. Now that, he'll go on in the next section to argue that, the impossibility of the fundamental revision. But this is a major claim that he's making. This judgment is not subject to radical revision. It isn't. All right, why? 16. The impossibility of such revision appears from the very notion of revision. A revision appeals to data. It contends that previous theory does not satisfactorily account for all the data. It claims to have reached complementary insights that lead to more accurate statements. It shows that these new statements either are unconditioned or more closely approximate to the unconditioned than previous statements. Now, if in fact revision is as described, then it presupposes that cognitional process falls on the three levels of presentation, intelligence, and presupposes that insights are cumulative and complementary. It presupposes that they head towards a limit described by the adjective satisfactory. It presupposes a reflective grasp of the unconditioned or of what approximates to the unconditioned. Clearly, revision cannot revise its own presuppositions. A reviser cannot appeal to data to deny data, to new insights to deny insights, to new formulation to deny formulation, to reflective grasp, to deny reflective grasp. And so any attempt to radically revise this judgment would be employing the activities that one is denying. You'd be using it. You would be appealing to data, claiming that you understand the data better than he does, and judging that your understanding is more accurate than his. So you would be using the operations that he's talking about. That doesn't mean you can't fill it out. Doesn't mean that there's a lot more to be done. But the suggestions, for instance, that I'm making with regard to empirical consciousness, the empirical consciousness of a human being as involving some overflow of intelligence to receive statements, words, data, meaningful data, and so on, is filling this out. But you can't deny, without self-contradiction, the structure itself. That's the claim. It's irrevocable, irreversible, not subject to fundamental revision. I'm going to just take go out on a limb here for a moment and say that if he's right, I think he is, that this is an epochal moment. This chapter is an epochal moment in the history of philosophy because it's the definitive movement into a stage of meaning that is governed by interiority. Lonergan, he distinguishes in Method and Theology three stages of meaning: common sense, theory, and interiority. And he claims that even in insight that the modern world has been heading towards interiority as the monitoring factor for meaning. And I think that this judgment of self-affirmation is the beginning of a secure plateau for what modernity has been heading towards for four centuries, appealing to human interiority as the arbiter of meaning. If this is the case, then this is the foundational judgment from the third stage of meaning. And it's been filled out with the addition of the fourth level, later on with at least the suggestion of a fifth level, which is the experience of grace, the gift of God's love, with the psychic conversion that talks about the emergence of images out of unconscious neural process into consciousness. Another filling out of this same structure, and then with Lonergan's statement that the structure proceeds not only from below upwards, experience, understanding, judgment, and seeing, but also from above downwards. You fall in love, it changes your values, it changes your cognitive take on the world, it changes your experience, it changes your dream. So it goes both ways. But this is the beginning of that. You can go both ways. You can fill it out, and we can continue to fill it out. It's a posthumously discovered paper where he actually talks about six levels. Down here, the dream, empirical, intelligent, rational, existential, and love, religious love. So that's a filling out of it. Here he's got three. This is the basics of it. I think it's a very important philosophical point. Major. It's kind of a leap in being in the ontology of meaning. Something that takes place here. The beginning of a new set of schemes of recurrence, new habits, and cognitive proxies. Very important moment. So that's going on a limb. I don't know whether history will have that judgment on it or not, but that's what I think. And finally, section 9 arrives at the same conclusion, the irrevisability of the judgment, by setting forth the a priori conditions of any possible judgment of fact. If there is any judgment of fact, so we're talking here, now let me get rid of all these other things because this could be just confusing. If there is any judgment of fact, no matter what its content, there is also a concrete unity identity whole that experiences some given, that inquires, understands, and formulates, that reflects, grasps the unconditioned, and so affirms or denies. Namely, I, you. Such a concrete unity identity whole is a thing itself, for it is defined by an internally related set of operations, and the relations may be experientially validated in the conscious and dynamic states of inquiry, leading from the given to insight, of insight leading to formulation, of reflection leading from formulation to grasp of the unconditioned, of that grasp leading to affirmation or denial. Again, other theory reaches its thing itself by turning away from the thing as related to us by sense or by consciousness. But cognitional theory reaches its thing itself, namely me, by understanding itself and affirming itself as concrete unity in a process that is conscious empirically, intelligently, and rationally. And then I didn't go into the last part. I didn't really think that we would have time. I actually would have. But because this is similar to what Kant would name a transcendental deduction, section 10 contrasts this position with that of Kant. Section 11 contrasts it with relativism. Briefly, on those two things, the issue is, well, first of all, the major, I may have mentioned this already, the book by Giovanni Sala, called Lonergan and Kant, Five Essays on Human Knowing. Five Essays on Human Knowledge. It's in the Regis Library. I may have put it on reserve. It's also in the London Research Institute Library, translated by a former student here at the University of Toronto in philosophy, Joseph Spurrell. The first essay in that book is The Notion of the A Priori in London and Kant, And content is a priori. There are sets of concepts that you're born with, that you impose upon experience. So this level imposes concepts on and organizes this level. And this level is collapsed into this one in Kant. Okay? Judgment is not adequately distinguished from understanding. And understanding, insight is not emphasized. Rather, concept is emphasized. And concept is imposed upon, dumped upon experience and organizes it. That's a little harsh, and then it's a very restricted, it's a very sophisticated presentation. And in Lonergan, what's a priori is nothing but the questions that promote the inevitabilities of moving from experience to understanding to judgment. All concepts are emergent from insight. All content is emergent from the process. We are not born with ideas or concepts that we dump on experience. They all emerge from experience. And hopefully from inquiry. Concepts can also be placed into us through learning, and that can be a good or a bad thing, depending on the concepts and who's doing it and how we're doing it. But the real issue is that the emergence of all concepts is emergence out of inquiry into experience. And then judgment in Lonergan is quite distinct from the second level of understanding and conceptualization. In terms of the contrast with relativism, for the relativist, you have to understand everything about everything in order to make a true judgment. And so you've got to know everything at this level. You've got to have all the relations, because everything's interrelated. And so if I don't know all the relations of everything to everything, then I don't know anything. And what Lonergan is saying is, no matter what else may be the case, this is a desk. Or I'm an or, we're here at 20 minutes to 4 on Thursday afternoon. Those are all true judgments. You don't have to know everything about everything to know something about something. And knowing something about something is all that he's saying you do. You know something about something. You're an or, period. So that's the main argument within his contrast with another person. Dorothy.
Maybe a silly question, but I was just thinking about the concept that snakes are bad. We're not born thinking that snakes are bad. We only figure out later that snakes are bad or not.
No, we don't like snakes. I think there's, but is that conceptualization, or is it something at a more empirical level? You know, I don't know.
We eat them in the outback. And some of the creative figures are snakes.
That's true. There are mythical uses of snakes that are quite popular.
So that would be part of the common fund, wouldn't it? If you're talking about the presentation, be conditioned on the cultural context.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I'm not sure. At any rate, it's not Kant's, he had 12 sets of categories. I'm not even sure that they included snakes. substance and time and all of those things.
Yeah, and some of those, some of those don't contradict this at all,
no.
I think are necessary. I mean, you can't, like self and other and space and time, I mean, that doesn't contradict this, and I think that in a complete sense of cognition, you need them both.
Space and time for there is a difference though too. I mean, certainly in the account of space and time in Kant, he's giving you a Newtonian absolute space and absolute time. And the account of space and time in here is outstanding. So there is a very different account of it. Related but different.
But I think it's part of the idea. I mean, in our ability to try and create unity objects, there's some, as human beings, there are, I think we have some constraints on what it means to be an identity whole. I mean, that's, we just, it may evolve, but you have to start from somewhere. Otherwise, if you don't have that concept that there are, identities and holes out there to be found, you'll never find the first one.
Do you have a concept? Okay, all right. Do you have a concept of that, or do you have a notion? This is the notion. The notion of notion comes up in the next chapter. You have, you're heading towards something, and so you have an anticipation.
Maybe an operational thing.
It's an operation.
That's an anticipation.
Lonergan sharply distinguishes what he calls notions from what he calls concepts.
Yeah.
And notions we've got, where the notions are the things that move us along, that force us to raise ever further questions, because we're not there yet. So we've got this anticipation, and we somehow, there's this, I'm hesitant to use the expression now because it was just used by Donald Rumsfeld the other day. The known unknown, you know. Did anybody see, did you see this comment? They asked Rumsfeld about, what about all these weapons of mass destruction that were supposed to be in Iraq? And Rumsfeld, he sounded, for a brief moment, he sounded like Bernard Lawrence. He said, well, there's the known, and there's the known unknown, and there's the unknown unknown. That's right out of chapter 17. I wanted to ask, is he aware of the fact that horizon is what separates the known unknown from the unknown unknown, which is not Lonergan's notion of horizon. I doubt it. Anyway, there is the known unknown. I mean, we have an anticipating sense of it, and we know when we get there, you know. So there's a notion, operation.
Operation.
It's an operation. Notion, anticipation.
I think it was last week or the week before that you touched a little bit on this. And I'm assuming that now we can ask about anything.
You can ask anybody. All of them. We ask everything about everything. And it is. That's what it's like.
It's about that process. When Lonergan then kind of talks about the reversal, like when you have the experience of absolute falling in love, then everything else is changed. And I'm not sure I grasp it, but I guess I could, with some imagination, grasp that for an individual. What I'm trying to say is, how does that process happen on a collective level?
The process from above downward, from love down.
Yes. Which is the process of well, actually, it's the process of conversion on a collective level.
That's right. The question is one. It's like on the forefront of theology today, because if I'm understanding your question correctly, 30 years ago or so, we evolved or developed a social notion of sin, and we said we've always thought for all of these centuries, we thought of sin as only individual, and then we realized that sin is objectified. Social structures, sinful social structures, became a very major theological concept that a lot of very traditional and intelligent, but traditional people who were raised to think of sin as only individual had an awful time grasping that. How can a social system be sinful? It's only individuals that are sinful, but the sin is objectified in the structures that cause injustice and suffering and so on. And I think that what we must develop now is an equally powerful social doctrine of grace, and of what grace would be, of what healed social structures, healed and healing social structures would be. And what is it that makes for a community, a civil level or whatever, that where grace is operative. So you're right, you're formulating a question that theology, I think, is just beginning to move into. I think we will be developing a social doctrine of grace in the same way that in the last century we developed a social doctrine of sin. But how to articulate that any further. I don't know, because even in the individual, Fred Crow never tires of saying, the movement from above downwards, there's a lot of work to be done. Lonergan's done an awful lot on articulating the movement from below upwards. But that movement from above downwards, the dynamics of it, and how falling in love changes perceptions of values, and how perceptions of values changes one's cognitive take, and so on. And so we all know that it's true. I mean, it does make a difference. The world is different. The world that you know is different if you're in love. You see things that you don't see otherwise. But what's the dynamic? It's not the same as the unrestricted desire to know moving from below upwards that simply will not stop until it's satisfied. It's something else that's going on. What is it? What's the operator from above downwards? I don't know that we know the answer to that yet. So we have to work it out even in terms of the individual. This judgment in this book is the start of all of this. And then I think that added to it, I mean, slowly in Lonergan's own career was fourth level, then fifth level, then up and down, and then I think the psychic conversion adds something more to it with the images coming out of the unconscious and so you've got. But there's still a lot to be done to unpack that. And then to apply it socially. It's open, I mean, but it's a very important question.
In Method, somewhere around, I think it's page 113 thereabouts, there's a beautiful description that he ends that by saying, to be in love with love. Now, if you start with the downward movement, his favorite idea is Romans 5:5. Mm-hmm. Does that have something to do with changing the horizons?
Yep.
In other words, if you go up the ladder, it's a gradual increase in consciousness,
yeah.
An increase in awareness.
Right.
It's a slow process, oftentimes going back,
yeah.
and slowly reaching up to that. All of a sudden, is the horizon all of a sudden beyond your comprehension? I've seen this on retreats with people. This on a simple weekend retreat, you know, it's just like it blows them away.
Yeah.
And they struggle with that.
Yeah.
They struggle with that going down,
yeah.
To readjust themselves.
Yeah.
Does it have to do something with that horizon that's available to
that's
them?
That's what it is.
Struggle with
that. It is
a
shift.
Yeah.
You're reminding me too, and coming back to Nadia's question from this, that the up and down was the first place where Lonergan expressed it was in a paper called Healing and Creating in History, which is 1975, I believe. So it's post-Method. He wasn't talking about the downward movement as such in Methodic theology. And that's where he locates his own attempts at economic theory, is in the downward movement. That, I mean, an economic theory develops from below upwards, but it can be a healing. It's not enough, he said, to decry the injustice of the present economic situations if you aren't prepared to, in economic terms, to suggest an alternative. And so, I mean, we can prophetically denounce, and he wasn't saying you can't do that. But ultimately, you've got to replace it with something else. And Gustavo Gutierrez is the one who asked the theologians at Notre Dame at a conference, and this was one of the motivating factors in Lonergan turning in his last years back to economics. Would you people in North America who still have a little leisure, please develop an economic theory that is an alternative to either Marxism or late capitalism, because neither one of them is working. Our whole continent is being starved because there isn't an economic theory that is adequate. And so a healed situation would be one where there's economic justice built into the structures, built into the economic structures.
So
Is anybody working on that now?
Mm-hmm.
Who's working on that now?
Lonergan's Economics, Mike Shute at Newfoundland, he's writing a book which was going to be published by the University of Toronto Press, and I think it'll be good. Mike does is a good, clear writer. Pat Byrne and at Boston College. Gord Rickson here at Regis College is the one around here who understands it. Lonergan's economics is very, very difficult. It's extremely scientific economic thinking. It's very hard.
I have a couple questions, and then the first one might not really be a question or an issue at all. In terms of empirical consciousness, your use of the word reception, his use of the word inevitability, I'm trying to think, terms that keep coming up for me are active and passive.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's relevant.
It's relevant, really, to all of the issues, to all of the levels, active and passive. Because there's an active and a passive character to each one of those levels, not just the empirical level.
That's right.
Sensation is basically passive. And what's active in sensation is the object. The object is what causes the sensation, if you go with Aristotle and Thomas. But intelligere est pati in St. Thomas's, to understand is to receive. That there's a receptive moment in understanding itself, because metaphysically the age of intellect illuminates the phantasm and deposits the intelligible species in the possible intellect. That's the whole, that's a very quick run through the metaphysics there. But there's a reception of the intelligere. Intelligere is received. There's a certain amount. That's why we can experience insight as a gift. You know, we experience it as, even though it's our own work, it's also something that happens to us, and that's the receptive element. Yeah.
The other question then is this use of imagining being part of empirical consciousness.
Yeah.
In my reading, it seems that there's a number of, especially the hermeneutic philosophers, that imagination is really inquiring. Is that maybe the link between the two?
Yeah. It is the link between the two. Yeah. Because insight itself is always into image, and so the content of an insight is an illuminated image. You know? It's an image where the form of the intelligible element is wrapped. An idea is basically an image that's been lit up, because you've got the meaning. That's going. It's a little bit loose use of mind, not too. Yes.
So my question, I guess, during the break,
yeah.
This is like what I am. It's not who I am.
Right, and it's only a part of what you are.
Right.
Yeah.
But even in that sense, I mean. When I'm really operating in the world, it's both the what I am and the who I am.
That's right.
that are impinging on each other.
That's right.
And so that case of the multiple personalities, there could be multiple. It's the same what, but there's multiple who's. Sometimes you got one
that's
who,
good.
And sometimes you have another one.
That's right. And the who you are is, to a large extent, is a function of psychic factors.
All of that other, yeah, but together they mold each other. They mold each other.
That's helpful.
You're not talking about a split personality or...
Well, just
ordinary...
You have a theory, you have all your biases, you have your theory of who you are. You're not just this inquiring thing. You define yourself, too.
Right.
But that does affect how you see it. It affects all your perceptions, too. So the two work together. The what you are and the who you are work together.
Yeah, and this is only a partial judgment even of the what you are.
Yeah, yeah.
It's only partial. But he's saying that just because it's partial doesn't mean it isn't true.
That's right.
You know, because all judgments are single. They're all limited. All of our judgments are limited. None of us knows everything about everything. None of us even knows everything about anything, about any single thing. But that doesn't mean we don't know anything about it.
So you were talking about the top-down development, and you said that you were talking about how Father Crowe mentioned that there's so much work that needs to be done there.
Yes.
He said we're not even sure what the operators are. Yeah. How are you using that word, operator?
The operator, the terminology that comes up in Chapter 15 here, it's a metaphysical term for learning. What moves you? Well, what moves you from one level to another?
Are these the transcendental notions, the heuristic anticipations? The question that I have about that is, what would it mean to have a transcendental notion when we're talking about grace? Because that's God's self-communication.
No, that's right. And this is part of what we are. The whole thing is a set of is a transcendental anticipation,
yes,
of the gift of God's grace and its obediential potency. Now, in fact, though, you could, in Lonergan's sense of the word notion, you could say that this is a set of transcendental notions that will only be satisfied,
yes,
when God, you have made us for yourself.
Yes.
But we will not rest until we rest in you. And we will not rest in you until you give yourself to us. So, but this is, we are notions, in that, yes, Lonergan sense of notions. You've made us for yourself. We're heading towards you. But that will not be satisfied until you give yourself to us.
So what was it that you were referring to when you said we don't know what the operators are on this level?
What I meant was we know what the operator is that moves me from empirical consciousness to intelligent,
yes,
consciousness. The question, what is it?
Right.
What's
not
going
there.
On? And then is it, or is it so, and is it good? But to go from what is it that operates from love to a change in values? Is it a question, or is it, you know, what's promoting that?
That's where I'm confused, because, yeah, just like you mentioned or pointed out wonderfully with obediential potency, that we have been made as this question, this yearning that is satisfied only with,
right,
God's gift and God's self.
Right.
So then what does that mean then when Lonergan talks about a development that has as its ground this gift? I want to emphasize development. Like, what does it mean to develop? So then I'm curious about what it means to have an operator to develop upon this ground.
Well, what? See, but you know that grace changes your values.
Yes.
All right. Now, in your own experience, how do you name what it is that's effecting that change? That's the question.
So here, it's the aesthetic direction as opposed to the intellectual.
It's definitely not an intellectual
right,
strategy.
So
it's something other than that.
Yeah.
And it's only to get a name for it. It's not a question.
Is that the passionateness of being?
The passionateness of being is all this thing from there upwards.
It's the
emerging probability of the universe, ultimately. You know, I mean, passionateness is a metaphorical term for it, before consciousness.
What Augustine calls the restlessness.
Restlessness.
Yes,
that's from below upwards. What I'm saying now, or what Crowe is saying, is we don't have a word yet for what it is that moves you from the experience of God's grace to the change of your
right.
But the change of your values, like, that's what I want to get at. That's what I want to try and understand. What is operating with this change of values? Because
that's what I'm saying.
Right.
That's
what I'm saying. It's something
saying
to do with aesthetic, and it's something to do with aesthetic. It's something to do with beauty and the large coming down. Rather.
It could be. I mean, I'm not sure.
Well, I'm not sure either. But I'm just taking. I'm not sure either. I'm
but
just taking a shot.
But this something to do with grace, and I think that the question is what kind of continuity? Is it disproportionate? It's obviously disproportionate in the sense
sure.
that it's God's self, and it's not like, what were you just saying, the transcendental notion that we are?
Yeah.
So,
okay.
Well, what is the relationship?
I think Sheldon's is onto something here, because values are apprehended in feelings. So it's something that happens in that dimension, that is the shifts the values, shifts your apprehensions and values. From a loveless universe, all of a sudden the universe becomes a home, a place where you can be safe.
But isn't the operator there just simply love?
But what I want, it is, but what we have to get at, I mean, it's also, you could say that the operator of all of this is wonder. But we, Lonergan's articulated that wonder out into at least three different kinds of questions. And so is there a way, what Crow is saying is, what are we going to do to name what love is doing here and what it's doing at this level and what it's doing down here? That we still, there's a vocabulary that remains to be developed. He's just saying Lonergan just opened it up. Whereas with the way from below upwards, he pretty well laid out the terrain. He made a map for it.
Made it intelligent in a way? Mm-hmm. Tried to make it more intelligent?
Well, to survey it the same way that he surveyed the movement from below upwards, to give us the names of the streets on the way down, you know, just as he gave us the names of the streets. That's what Crow was saying.
Yeah.
We know there's a way down. We know that this happens, but there's a mystagogy or there's a mystical theology that is only beginning to be expressed.
I think it's wonderful. I like the idea of this, point shown with the feelings and everything like that. The question I guess I'm just trying to articulate is just the ambiguity around the relationship between whatever these feelings would correspond to in terms of transcendentals,
yeah.
And how that transcendental would be related to the transcendental notions of the good and the true, perhaps the beautiful. I mean, that's still needs to be worked beauty
yeah,
on the
those
way
are,
up to.
Those are issues that, yeah. Nadia, and then we got to go. We're over time.
The reason why I asked that question before about social transformation is because I guess this is my hunch. What I see by the process in reverse is that the person has to become completely open to the other, in the sense that if you have this experience of unconditional and complete love in God, then automatically the first sense that you have is that others like that. So you want others to experience that too. So it seems to me that whilst the process up is very much the building of the person, the process down has to be completely social, because the person then becomes a person for the other and no longer the person for self. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes a lot.
Amen, sister.
And you said something beautiful that I think that you underlined, that foundations, when we talk about the functional specialties, I mean, that foundations has to be pragmatic engagement. And engagement is certainly self-engagement, but it's about the gift of charity, which isn't it so that Lonergan has called charity a willingness, only it's a universal willingness. And so however we can spell out what that willingness is that moves beyond self satisfaction to value, that moves me all the way down. So I suppose there's a known unknown sense of what that might look like, but it's searching for the geography and the place names.
Place names.
But how you do it when it's more mystical than scientific and pragmatic is touchy.
I think we better go because if we're thank you. So have a wonderful Christmas. And come back ready for explore the notion of being. When you come back, you will be introduced to everything about everybody.
Can I just tell you where I get started?
Yes.